Hey friends, welcome back to Words with the Wise. I'm your host, Lexi Maynor. Today's guest is someone who has spent much of his life helping other people achieve their dreams. Ted Baker. Ted Baker is the executive director of the Innovation Connector in Muncie, Indiana, where for more than 15 years, he has helped entrepreneurs launch businesses, solve problems, and pursue ideas they once thought were impossible. But long before that, Ted built businesses of his own, raised a family, and learned firsthand what it means to lead with faith, humility, and service. In this conversation, Ted shares stories from his childhood in Decatur, Indiana, the example set by his parents, the lessons he's learned through nearly 5 decades of marriage, and the mentors who shaped the way he views leadership and success. We also talk about entrepreneurship, why he believes seeing others win is one of life's greatest joys, and how his relationship with Jesus has guided every season of his life. What I love most about Ted is that while he has helped countless people and businesses succeed, he rarely takes credit for it. Instead, he sees his life as a platform to serve others and to point people back to God. Whether you're a business owner, a leader, a person of faith, or simply someone looking for encouragement, I think you'll find a lot of wisdom in this conversation. So without further ado, here is Ted Baker's story.
Hi, my name is Ted Baker. I am almost 69 years old. So in 2026, I'll be 69. Which is an amazing number to me that I could even reach this height. And I used to think that was really old. And now I find out it is. I grew up in a little town called Decatur, Indiana, mm-hmm. which is north of where I live now in Muncie. Mm-hmm. And grew up just in a small town. And a family, mom and dad, with 3 sisters and 2 brothers.
Oh, big.
And we just lived a normal life.
Yeah, so what, there were 6 of you?
6 of us.
Nice. And plus, where did you fall in that order?
I had a twin sister.
Oh, I didn't
And
know
we were sixth, or fifth and sixth. Okay. She was sixth, I was fifth.
Oh, so you were co-baby of the families.
Yes, yes. And nice. And I have proof from the Decatur Daily Democrat paper, newspaper, that I was born 1 minute ahead of her. So
hey,
I was
go.
Never the baby of the family.
I know a lot of twins, and you need that proof sometimes.
Yeah, I do. And my sister often told me that, well, they just said that because they put the boys first. That was just common practice because we were born cesarean 1 minute apart.
Okay.
And so, yeah.
Nice. Were you really close with her growing up?
For a while. Uh-huh. And then, of course, high school happened, and, you know, we stayed pretty close. Then,
yeah.
We both went different places to college. I went to Ball State University, and she went to Franklin College.
Oh, yeah.
And then life happens, and we grew.
We proceeded
our lives in different communities and different cities and towns, doing our thing, family stuff. And then it wasn't until, you know, then years after we both had kids and all that, she lived in a little town called North Manchester, Indiana.
Yeah.
I lived in Muncie, and we just became really close again. So,
yeah, that's great.
Unfortunately, about... this Labor Day will be 3 years that she passed away.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, that was a hard one, but now I'm the baby of the family.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, so let's kind of bring it back to where you came from, your parents. What were your parents like?
Well, very traditional.
Okay.
Not quite, Ward and June Cleaver. Mm-hmm. You probably don't know who they are.
I've heard references.
Leave it to Beaver. Okay.
Okay, yeah.
But mom was a stay-at-home mom.
Mm-hmm.
Never, ever, ever was in the mindset that she would find a job or have a job. That was not the mindset back in that day, especially in a small town. And so my father worked at there were two General Electric factories and facilities, one in Decatur and actually 2 in Fort Wayne. And he was like the manager over HR, payroll, all of that stuff. And so he was manager there. And so he worked there for 43 years. And so, I mean, we probably were upper middle class, but maybe on the higher side of that. Mm-hmm. But there was no distinction back then.
Yeah.
You know, my dad just worked hard. I can remember him working 8 to 5. That was a normal day.
Mm-hmm.
And mom stayed home and made sure everything was okay in the house. She would sometimes go look for dust because she was thinking that she had to clean. And so she literally would say, I'm just looking for dust. but But he worked. My dad was very, very hardworking.
Yeah.
And so a good income and such. And the thing about that, too, is that I remember my father being a very kind person. He was a peacemaker, mm-hmm. as far as the type of person he was. And then in that, he was so generous, too. And it was something that I was impressed with.
Yeah, yeah. And what would you say your typical day like was like as a kid?
Fun.
Uh-huh.
Relatively happy, right? I think I was funny.
Uh-huh.
But that's what I think, right? People think that's funny.
Well, when you're co-baby of the family, I feel like even though you weren't the baby, I feel like when you are the baby, a lot of times they're pretty funny.
I tried to be. I lived a very simple life.
Uh-huh.
There weren't a lot of... there were no devices that we...
Yeah.
And back when I was in at home and younger, we did have a TV. It was black and white because mm-hmm. color TVs weren't a thing then.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't have remote controls, and there were three channels on the TV. So we played outside a lot.
Yeah.
We were outside as... If it was nice enough, we were outside. And if it wasn't nice enough, we were still outside.
Yeah.
And so I loved sports, though. Anything sports. And we lived right across the street from the Decatur swimming pool, which was a big public pool, huge. Mm-hmm. Of course, when you're little, everything is big like
yeah.
that. And so anyway, I pretty much lived at the swimming pool. Loved it.
Mm-hmm.
So it was fun. I had a lot of friends, just... You know, and I went to a private Catholic school.
Okay.
And so it was pretty close-knit.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah, so it was really good. I had other friends in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
And one thing I do remember very distinctly was just riding our bicycles all over town. And, like, if I lived in that, if I lived there, even though it's just still the same type of town,
mm-hmm.
relatively safe and all this stuff, I wouldn't let my kids ride all over town and not know where they're at.
Yeah.
Even in a small town, I probably wouldn't do that. And we just did whatever. You know, we just rode around.
Uh-huh.
Our parents didn't, you know, as long as we were inside when the streetlights went off,
yes.
Came on. Yeah.
That phrase, the amount of times I've heard that phrase in these interviews, I love it, though. I wish we lived in a world where that was still the case. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Many times I was running as the streetlights were coming on, like, wait. You know, but anyway,
don't go on. I had to... So I know you said that you were funny, fun as a kid, but anything else that you want to tell us personality-wise, traits of you as a young boy?
I was very inquisitive.
Mm-hmm.
I liked problem solving. I loved to see things that needed to be solved.
Mm-hmm.
I think because I was raised with other siblings, I was always trying to prove my place in the family. So I think I was somewhat goal-oriented, like, I'm going to show them up or whatever. And so mm-hmm. I was like that. Somewhat, maybe I could say a people pleaser,
yeah.
but really not people. I just wanted to make sure that my parents were pleased.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were both great role models to me, especially my father. And so that's kind of the way it was. I went to school, did well in school. I think I just liked life.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't have to do anything to prove anything else. And yeah. so I just loved life. I found joy in about everything that I did.
Yeah. That's a great thing to be able to say.
Yeah. I still think that way too. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. And what were some more of your hobbies growing up? I know you mentioned a few, but.
The number one hobby had anything to do with sports. If it was a ball, a hockey puck, anything, a swimming pool, anything doing with sports. I was grew up a big Cubs fan. It was nice. A genetic defect. I couldn't help
uh-huh.
it. A big Notre Dame football fan. Again, you know, a Catholic family.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
Hour and a half from South Bend is, you know, you're...
Huge Fighting Irish.
Yeah, fans. You're stuck. But so anything related to sports and playing sports. And again, we didn't have that much opportunity to watch sports on TV. There just weren't any. And there was like one... There, like in Major League Baseball, there was like one game a week, the Major League Baseball game of the week on mm-hmm. Saturdays. So there weren't a lot of sports on TV because we just had three channels.
Yeah.
And so it was meant that you had to play the sports.
Yeah.
And so I would, anytime I was up for a team, like middle school, you could start playing football, soccer, basketball. In the summer, there were summer baseball leagues. I mean, I was, every season, I was playing
there.
some sort of sport. You know, and especially in the summer, I loved being at the swimming pool. If that was a hobby, you know, being with friends and just, I call it just hanging out.
And good hobby to have.
And we actually talked to each other. We would, you know, bicker with each other. We would pick at each other. You know, you'd get a fist fight going with your best friend, and next thing you know, you're out, you know, drinking from the water hose together because we were hot and thirsty. But it was just being around people, not really a lot of hobbies.
Well, I think just hanging out, that's the best hobby there is. I like it.
I agree.
Yeah. Is there a childhood memory that stands out to you today?
Yeah. I mean, I have a couple. my mother was, my mom and dad met in New York City. My mom was from the coal mining hills of Pennsylvania. Her parents immigrated from the Ukraine around 1895. So it was a long, long time ago. That was my grandparents. And so my grandfather came over to work in the coal mines. And so he passed away not too long after from some coal disease, coal mining, you know, black lung or something. They just called it. He died. And so back then, when that happened, they didn't have Social Security or anything like that. So, yeah, my mom, when she turned 16, she moved to New York City with her sister so that they could work in the city. Now, remember, she's 16. She went to New York City on her own.
That is crazy.
Because they needed to raise money or earn money and send it back to home so mom could live. And that's what they did.
Okay.
So she and her sister. really unique thing about this is... my mom worked in the hotel industry. My mom never finished I think sixth grade was the highest she ever went to school.
Wow.
Because it was back then, and they lived in the hills, right? And so my mom knew how to work really hard. But anyway, she worked in the hotel industry, which meant she took care of, like, cleaning the, an apartment complex, but they called them hotels back then, but they're apartments. And so she was one of the floor keepers. And so she tended to the different homes, I guess, the apartments of people who lived there. And one of her clients, or one of her apartments she took care of, was the apartment home of Glenn Miller, the big band. And then also Jimmy Dorsey band. They were both on her floor.
And then
Tommy Dorsey was the floor below. But she's, you know, so she has good memories from that. So you asked me about my childhood memory of, we would go back to New York City from Decatur, Indiana. We'd take the train, and we'd go.
How long of a train ride would that be?
It was a day and a half.
Overnight,
I can remember that.
Yeah.
But we'd go see her sisters, and we'd spend a couple weeks, 2-3 weeks in New York City, and I just loved that time. I just love being there. There's something about it. And then my father would come and meet us out there. He would drive out, and then he'd stay like a week or two, and then we'd all drive home. Just hanging out in the city with my dad, because he knew it very well, because he went there to go to school.
Where did he go?
He went to the New York Institute of Photography.
Oh, cool.
And so he always did that as a hobby. So anyway, that's kind of, you know, a good memory there. One, you know, I can just remember my older sisters having, like, parties at our house. And, here's this young boy, and then these girls that were seniors, you know, in high school, and they were over at our house, you know. You know, and parties would make, you'd have popcorn and chips and some Coca-Cola, right? I think they slipped in some things, but don't think anybody ever knew that. But just being around that atmosphere, I loved it. I'll never forget, as this has been etched in my mind for a long time, just kind of like the respect I have for my mom and dad. But my mom being home, at 5 o'clock when dad got home, dinner was ready. And we were expected to be home.
Yeah.
And just the way it was. And you ate then, and you ate what was on the dinner table too. You didn't say, like, I don't like that. That didn't happen. But I can remember my dad coming in the back door up the steps, parked in the back of the house, and walked in. And I was in the kitchen, and Mom wasn't in there. And I can remember him saying one time, where is she? Where's my wife? And then she came in the room, and he grabbed her and put his hands on her face. He got real close. He said, I missed you so much today.
Oh.
And gave her a big hug. And then, you know, he would give her a kiss. And sometimes they would even dip, you know, and all that stuff. Uh-huh. But so as a young kid, we're going, ooh, ick, yuck.
Yeah.
But I look back and I'm going, he's got it. That was really good. That was really, really good. And so even me, 68 plus years later, I remember that.
Yeah.
And so he had so much respect for my mom, even so much so as if we got in trouble and Dad wasn't home, you know, we maybe said something or shouldn't have did something that we shouldn't have done something we did or said something. If Mom would say something to Dad, it was like, there was hell to pay.
Yeah.
And he, I can remember one other time. We're kind of going.
No,
off the
I love that. This is what this is
but
for.
My brother, one time, said some cross words to my mom, and he was kind of a rebel, but great.
He grew out of it.
Yeah, he's such a good guy. But anyway, he was kind of a rebel. But anyway, he said something very cross to my mom, and when Dad got home, Mom was still upset. What happened? And she said something, and he went, and my dad was a small man, you know, not a very tall guy at all, and went over to my brother, and I'll never forget this. He said, he got right into my brother's face and said, don't you ever offend my wife again. Now, I thought that was interesting because it was his mother.
Yeah, rather than he said my wife.
My wife, because that was like, he knew that they were one together.
Uh-huh.
And it was, I thought, my first thought was, my brother can be replaced. So anyway, but those are things that I remember.
You stick with you.
And just good friends. My neighbor across the street, Mark, and I were just such good friends. And yeah, so those are really, really good memories.
Yeah.
But that's kind of like just a simple life.
Mm-hmm. I love hearing you, how those impacted you so much and they like are etched in your brain. Like it just shows how the way you grow up and like the things that your parents say to you, like they do carry you through, mm-hmm. which for some that's good, some that's sad. Cause
I'm
it's like
very, very, I'm so blessed. I'm so feel fortunate to have had that example.
Yeah.
Because I could have been blind to all of that, not seen mm-hmm. it, but it just seems like things were set up so that I would see it.
Yeah.
And then they were etched in my heart and mm-hmm. in my brain.
Yeah. Were there any early influences that shaped your character, your faith, kind of probably tying into that?
Sure. You know, I grew up a very strong Catholic boy.
Mm-hmm.
And while I don't practice Catholic faith now, I'm very, very grateful for my upbringing. And mm-hmm. and the reason is that the Catholic faith taught me reverence for God. And I'm not a big critic of any of that, but it just taught me that, you know, there was a reverence toward God. There was a holiness to God. There was a mystery somewhat. And I liked that.
Yeah. The mystery of faith.
Yeah. And it also demanded some respect. And so part of that was, you know, very, very, very cool to me, going to a private Catholic school, grades 1 through 8. Thinking of faith, I had a second grade teacher. She was a nun, which we had mostly nuns. Mm-hmm. I didn't know, like, this was when they were in their full attire habits, they called them.
Yeah.
And all I can remember is seeing their face, the round part of their face, and their hands. That's the only part you ever saw of a nun.
Yeah.
But anyway, my second grade teacher, her name was Sister Gemma. And Sister Gemma influenced my life so much. And so here I am many, many years later, you know, 60 years later, talking about Sister Gemma. Matter of fact, it was a number of years ago, my wife saw me open up my wallet or something. She goes, what's that picture in there? I said, it's a picture of Sister Gemma. And she goes, you know what? Maybe you shouldn't be carrying that around. And I go, well, it's just been in there all these years. But I said, she reminds me of the basics of faith. She reminds me. And she was the one that probably influenced me in that way more than anybody ever did. And it wasn't to be the best Catholic I can be. It was to love God and to love others. Mm-hmm. And so it was real simple, but as a second grader, and yeah. So I remembered that, and it was just phenomenal. So Sister Gemma and being raised Catholic, and then just my father and my mother, especially my father. Although I was a mama's boy, mm-hmm. I adored my father. They were just such good examples.
Yeah.
I loved the idea that he was a peacemaker. He was always one that could find some silver lining in about anything. And so I just loved that about him. But I think what it did is solidified my being, my soul, kind of, in that. And then as I became more aware of of the Lord and my mm-hmm. faith and such, all of that kind of made sense then. And so, yeah, so those are the things that really made a difference. And then when I was in high school, I met this girl
mm-hmm.
and kind of ended up liking her. But anyway, mm-hmm. And then she was solid in my life too, so it has been, because she's my wife now.
Yeah. I loved hearing you talk about how you enjoyed like growing up Catholic because of like the reverence and the respect. Because I feel like I have a not the same but like interesting perspective too. Because my mom grew up Catholic and like so did Billy, my uncle Billy. Yeah. Like as I'm sure you know, but I feel like I love that I didn't grow up that way. But I've like gone to Mass with my grandparents, and like it is. I don't like when people try to divide the two so much, because it's like, yes, you practice it differently, but there are a lot of good things that you get from the non-denominational or Catholicism, sure. Like all the different.
Well, one of the things, this is really good, but I loved the Easter season as a Catholic,
mm-hmm.
especially the Easter weekend. And I was an altar boy, and I taught altar boys, so I love that stuff. But when I was younger, Good Friday service was from noon to 3, which symbolized the 3 hours that Jesus hung on a cross.
Yeah.
And in the Catholic Church, in the church we went to in Decatur, it was taken with a lot of seriousness. And so back in my day, everything shut down from 12 to 3. All the businesses, all the banks, all the restaurants, all the grocery stores.
Yeah.
Nothing was open. So there was this expectation. But you would be in this church service for 3 hours, and they would be doing the Stations of the Cross, and just in. And I remember the looking at the decorations, or I guess the attire of the church. Everything was decked out in black, draped in black, deep red, symbolizing the blood of Christ, symbolizing the dark day, the death, and such. And from my recollection then, at 3 o'clock when everybody was gone, it was really the only day of the year then that the church doors were locked. Because they were pretty much open. You could go in, even though it was this great big, almost cathedral-like building. But you could go in any time. But it was locked until Easter morning. And when you went back in on Easter, there were beautiful colors, flowers, pastel colors, bright, white, light.
Yeah.
And it was just, I'll never forget seeing that, because the great symbolism of that. The new life and such. So mm-hmm. I love that about that stuff. And sometimes mm-hmm. in our faith right now, in our Christian faith and the way we walk it's almost like it's, I guess, too nonchalant. It's just easy, you know, instead of thinking of the meanings behind things.
Yeah, and I do think, I think it's somewhere in the middle is how, because, like, I do think sometimes my grandma growing up Catholic, I think she misses the whole, like, it's a relationship. Like, Jesus is, like, a friend. But also, like, then you, the second hand to that is, like, you miss the respect part. Yeah. Anyways, that was good. Is there something important your parents or mentors taught you that stuck with you, or, like, the greatest lesson your parents taught you?
Be kind.
Mm-hmm.
and be quick to forgive.
Mm-hmm.
I can just remember my father was always one of these people who would always give people the benefit of the doubt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think my mom was quick to judge, but you know, that's that happens.
Yeah,
nothing wrong, but she just had that. But my dad was always, he always gave people more than one, two, three chances. And as an example or something he taught me about being a father myself and a husband and head of a household, so to say, but even though, like, I've had brothers and sisters and they were growing up, and I was younger and I could see all this, but they got in trouble, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they all went through their rebellious times and such, which is a normal family.
Oh, yeah.
But my dad, I remember telling my brothers and sisters, I could hear him say this today, is that our front door of this house is always open. Don't ever hesitate to come back if you leave. It's always open for you. And, you know, I found out that I say the same thing. I've said the same things to my kids. No matter what, this door is always open. Mm-hmm. So if there's one thing that I could say that I took out of just learning how to relate was something like that. And then I never have forgotten this whole thing about the reverence of God.
Mm-hmm.
I just ingrained deeply into me. And so I have to kind of watch my tongue sometimes when I see irreverence or non-reverence going around. Mm-hmm. I mean, he is so big. He is so mm-hmm. holy. We just recently, my wife and I took a trip out west, and I stood on the south rim of the Grand Canyon for I had never been to the Grand Canyon. I've been in all 50 states, but not the Grand Canyon.
That's crazy.
And I went and stood at the south rim. I was just looking so forward to it. And I looked out, and there was just something. I had this revelation. I mean, it was just like this revelation or experience that I literally almost started shaking. And I just, you know, my wife says, "Are you okay?" You know, because I was just kind of like gawking, maybe. And I said, "Yeah." I said, "I'm looking," and I said, "Man, you know, who is this God?" Because it's so phenomenal. It's just anything. And I said, "Who are we that God is mindful of man?"
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look at what he did. Look at this.
Yeah.
And then I thought, and then on top of that, who am I that God is mindful of me? He knows the number of hairs that I have in my head. He knows my deepest thoughts. Who am I? And then I just said, who in the world is this God? It just really, I don't think I'll ever forget that moment. Just knowing that it was so, so powerful.
Yeah.
But it goes back to me understanding that the reverence of God, that I respected him in that creation. So.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. And it does take your breath away.
I know.
Let's talk a little bit more about high school. What do you remember most about your high school years?
One thing only, swim team. When I was a freshman, so, you know, it's like, I hung around the pool and all this stuff, but an October evening, I got a call on our landline, which is the only kind we had.
Yeah.
And I got the call upstairs about 9:30 at night, and a senior called me, who we used to, I knew his family very well, and
mm-hmm.
we all hung out at the pool together during the summer, but Paul called me, and Paul said, "I'll pick you up at 5:30 in the morning." And I said, "Why are you going to pick me up at 5:30 in the morning?" He goes, "Because you're on the swim team." That was my introduction.
Oh, okay.
And so I remember yelling from the top of the stairs to Mom, "Mom, you know where my swimsuit is?" You know, it's October. She goes, "Why do you need your swimsuit?" I said, "I guess I'm on the swim team." So he picked me up, and that was a whole new story.
Yeah.
And from that moment on, I was...
You loved it.
I was caught badly. I got hooked, and... Yeah, so I loved every moment of it. And my friend across the street, Mark, he was a year younger than me in school, but we both got addicted to it and worked really hard at it. I don't know, other things about high school. I was really challenged by classes. I think I've always enjoyed learning.
Yeah.
And so learning didn't bother me. I think if we'd go back medically, I'd probably be diagnosed with ADDDDHDDD.
I think I had it bad.
But I can remember being so bulldog determined that if I would read a chapter and I would think about it and I couldn't remember, or I just don't think I got it, I read it again.
Yeah.
And I'd read it 3 or 4 times. I did that through college.
Mm-hmm.
I loved math, uh-huh. algebra, calculus, trigonometry, physics. I loved all that. But if I didn't get it, boy, I dug into it until I got it. And that determination and that bulldogness really helped me in my business world.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. Did you always have an interest in business or leadership, I guess, in those years? Or did that come later?
Yeah, my dad, I just loved it.
Yeah.
You know, it's how some kids play dress up and, you know, they go. Well, when we had a little room off the side of the living room, it was just a small little room. We call it the blue room because guess what? It was blue. And it had a desk in there. And my dad helped people with their income taxes back in the day. But that was just like his little office. But, it was not very much. It was just like mm-hmm. a little corner of a room.
Yeah.
But I can remember going in that room when like no one else was in there. And I pretended I was a business person.
Aww.
And I was sitting at the desk and I pretended, all this stuff. And I loved that stuff. I loved it when Dad took me to his office because he'd have to go get something or whatever.
Uh-huh.
Oh my gosh, I just loved it. And it's kind of funny because when, like, I went to a school where it was pretty rural. I mean, my classmates in high school drove their pickup trucks to school.
Sounds like Delta, kind of.
Yeah, I know. But this will date me, but they left the car doors or truck doors unlocked. And they might have 3 guns on the rack in the back of their, hanging up there and unlocked and everything. You don't do that anymore.
No.
But so here are these guys, and they're talking about their tractors and their combines and stuff like that. I loved office supplies.
Uh-huh.
Staplers, paper clips, 3-hole punchers and stuff like that. I love that stuff. Different kinds of paper. So anyway.
Did you have any early jobs?
Oh my gosh, where do we start?
Oh no, a lot.
I loved doing stuff. And
yeah.
It was, and I thought about this. It was never about the money. My earliest job was when I was 8 years old. That's when I first started my first legitimate business.
Uh-huh.
And I sold Coca-Cola on the streets to farmers who were delivering their crops, corns and beans, to the... It was called Central Soya, which was a big beanery factory.
Uh-huh.
And they were delivering their goods to the Central Soya factory. And they would line up through our streets because harvest time came and they were all harvesting. And this was before drive-thrus, before village pantries or 7-Elevens or, Speedways. And here we are. I thought, well, I bet they're thirsty. And so I would buy Coca-Cola in the summer and store it because it was on sale in the summer. And then I'd store it, put it on ice, and then I'd come home from school and, take it out. Now, someone said, well, how did you, 8 years old, how did you have money to buy Coca-Cola? And I said, well, at that time, I didn't realize it, but I found an angel investor. Her name was Mom. But Mom helped me, and we kept tabs of it, and I paid her. But, yeah, and I think it taught me so much about, I saw a need.
Uh-huh.
I saw an opportunity. I had the solution. So that really set me... I'm going to do something here.
Yeah.
And then on Saturday mornings, I worked at this. My mom knew this lady, and they needed somebody to help clean her store. It's a ladies' clothing store.
Yeah.
Downtown. And I cleaned. I was worked from 9 to noon every Saturday. I got $8 for the whole morning. and I just did little odd jobs for them. Went to being a paper boy for the Fort Wayne Journal Gazette. Every morning, 5 o'clock, I had to be ready passing papers. Then I mowed lawns to do that too. I always saw what I did as helping people.
Yeah.
And then I became a lifeguard, which was my ultimate dream of my life was to become a lifeguard, which I did. And I did some coaching and swimming for the younger kids. Yeah. So I did all kinds of stuff. And, but I think that all set the stage for, I wasn't a job hopper. I just took off advantage of opportunities
as they came to you. Yeah, for sure. Looking back now, what would you say to your younger self during your high school years and younger years?
Take more risks. Take more chances. I'm very conservative. And I would take more chances on a lot of different things. I don't regret, because I don't live a life of regret, but I think I would have just been a little bit more daring, mm-hmm. take a little bit more risk. Knowing now what I know is that you'll get through it.
Yeah.
And but I did know I wasn't crazy. So I knew people who took risks, but they were crazy. You know, I'm not going to go jumping between buildings thinking I can make it over.
No, risks with reason.
That's right.
Yeah. There's not a question about this on here, but you said you went to Ball State University. What brought you to Ball State? Or what made you want to go there?
Two things. My girlfriend.
Yeah.
She came. She was a year ahead of me in school, but she came to Ball State. But they also had they had what I wanted. I was wanting a marketing degree.
Uh-huh.
It was close enough to home, but not too far.
Mm-hmm.
I did get a full ride scholarship.
Oh, amazing.
Academic, so that was nice. But I also swam on a swim team at Ball State.
Oh.
And so to me, all of that matching together worked out really well.
Yeah, it was a great fit.
Yeah, I love Ball State.
Uh-huh. It's a great university.
I made it through in 4 years. People said, you know, yeah, surprise. But no, you can do it. You know, but I love Ball State.
Uh-huh.
I got married at the end of my junior year.
Okay.
And it was my wife had just graduated, so yeah.
Yeah.
Going together 6 years, we were ready. So.
Uh-huh, 100%. Yeah, we'll get into that too later. Okay, so you go to Ball State, you graduate. What was your first job out of graduation?
I worked for a company in Anderson, Indiana called Barber Manufacturing. They sold springs and different supplies for the furniture industry. Springs that would go into, you know, you sit on the couch or whatever and you got a little bounce or whatever. And they were one of the largest spring manufacturers in the nation. It was really interesting because I graduated in 1980. If you look back in the history, 1980, 79, 80 was not a very good time to find a job.
Hmm.
Deep recession, very hard times. Matter of fact, I can remember on the shuttle bus from Scheidler Apartments, which were the married apartments at Ball State, going from Scheidler to campus every morning. That's kind of how you got to class, because I was still in class.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of travel every day with the same people because you're all going to class. And I can remember this guy who I knew is on the bus every day. And this was mid, maybe March or so. He shook the newspaper in front of my face, which was the Ball State Daily News, and he shook it in my face and he goes, "What are we going to do about this? What are we going to do about this?" Like, really mean, like.
He's like, "I don't know."
And he opened it up and it said, "Few jobs await college seniors."
Ooh.
So, of course, we're both married. We're in married housing, right? And he goes, "Well, so what are we going to do about this?" Because he was really freaking. And I said, I'll never forget this. I said, "I'm really not going to worry about it." I said, "If there are a few jobs, I only need one." And I was only one of like two or three people at Ball State University got hired through the Ball State Placement Office that year people came in and hired people.
Oh my gosh.
And
that's
so
crazy.
Yeah. And I think it was more of a mindset than anything. I wasn't anything special.
No. Yeah.
But I think it was more of a mindset. And I only stayed with that company 9 months or less than a year because by that time we had had a baby.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, this was after I graduated, and I traveled a lot, and I didn't want to do that.
Yeah. So where did you go from there?
I just quit, and I didn't have a job.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it was scary, but I was
took
not.
Took a risk?
Yeah, I was just not going to.
Miss out.
I was gone from Monday to Friday every week.
Oh,
and yeah. I didn't like that.
No.
No, I soon got a job with a company called American Design and Engineering here in Muncie. I spent 18 years there, ended up buying part of that company. And the guy who owned that, his name was Jim Amos. Jim was kind of like the hero mentor of my business career.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, there was a lot goes on with that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's how you first got into business ownership then?
Yeah. I spent 18 years or so working, leading Jim's company, growing it significantly. He put me in charge of just about everything, and I loved it. He was older. And I always saw, and again, he was the best, my bestie, you know. But he was getting older, like 70s.
Yeah.
And I saw his ship coming from the ocean, from the seas into the harbor, and mine was in the harbor ready to go out into the seas. And so we kind of passed each other. So I actually left the company and started working for another company, a friend of mine in the music business.
Okay.
And that friend went to school with me at Ball State too, and actually had worked in the same company with Mr. Amos that I did. But this friend of mine went full-time in music, and he asked me to come and work for him. After a couple days of being gone from the manufacturing company that I worked for, I got a call from Mr. Amos and said, hey, how would you like to buy part of my company? And that's how it started. So,
oh, wow. Yeah. What excited you most about entrepreneurship or like owning business ownership, I guess?
I just really loved creating. Mm-hmm. I just saw that as a platform to do what I really was called to do. You know, doctors, they go to school for medicine, and, you know, their platform or their stage or pulpit is, you know, their medical office, the hospital, whatever it is. You got that all over. But I saw business as my platform to be with people. Mm-hmm. And so I love the idea of creating something, solving a problem. Someone thinks it worthwhile enough to pay you. But again, I never, ever focused on the money.
Yeah.
And so the problem solution idea was great, but I really liked impacting others. What gave me more joy than anything was seeing someone else win, benefit something about that.
Mm-hmm. And that's probably why you're a great leader, because I feel like the best leaders like to take emphasis off themselves and
100% 100%
yeah,
because you can focus on yourself and get nowhere.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. What were some of the biggest lessons you learned early in your career?
Well, in my career of business ownership and getting into that, the very first and most important lesson was, it is really hard.
Yeah.
It's nothing easy about it. I am so glad I look back and I remember the value of hard work, watching my dad and my dad and mom made us work in the house, chores.
Yeah.
I can remember getting on my hands and knees and mom teaching the boys how to clean the baseboards on the floor with our hands and on the hands and knees cleaning the baseboards, right?
Mm-hmm.
You were expected to help around the house and you did that first. And sometimes it was really hard. My dad was a great man, but I think he knew how to teach us to work hard.
Yeah.
And then in the jobs that I had, nothing was easy. Having the paper out, getting up at 5 every morning to go pass papers and then come back and go to school. And this was 7 days a week.
Yeah.
This was hard stuff.
Hard stuff, so
I am so glad that I was taught to work hard.
Mm-hmm.
And if that was something ingrained in me, it was something that, I don't know, maybe who I am, the examples. You know, sometimes things are taught and sometimes things are caught. And
I like that.
I found out I caught a lot, okay? So some things are taught, some things are caught. And those are the things that I found out. The other thing is, I found out there's no shortcuts. If you're going to be on a business ownership or a business leadership journey, shortcuts don't work. There are no drive-through windows for it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got to go and you got to be committed to it. I'm so glad I learned those lessons early on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love the some things are taught, some things are caught. That's good. Never heard it
I'll
said
attribute
that
to a friend of mine here at the Innovation Connector who said that, but he heard it from someone too, but I it resonates with me big time.
Mm-hmm. What, were there any failures or, I mean, you said it's really hard, difficult seasons, I guess, that shaped how you lead today, though?
Oh, my gosh. You know, I'm an optimist, so it's often been said that I don't even see the glass half full. I see it overflowing all the time.
Uh-huh.
But I'm an optimist, so I always saw anything that didn't go the way I wanted to or failures as an opportunity to learn. A friend of mine told me, he said, well, you know what you are? And I go, what? And he said, you're a lifelong learner. You learn in everything. And I said, okay, well, I'll take that. But, you know, I've had, you know, all of my businesses were successful. I stuck with them and such. But within those businesses, there were things that were setbacks and such. And that's just part of life. Mm-hmm. Hard times are not easy. So I don't know if I really could say I had any, like, failures. I mean, there are times I felt like a failure, you know. But I don't think any of them were real failures. One of the things that I've always believed in is that God has a plan for my life.
Yeah.
And so it was a matter of learning to trust early and trust often. And I realized that nothing that I could do was in my own power anyway. And so I just decided that from an early time in business and such is that, the scripture is trust in the Lord with all your heart. Lean not to your own understanding, but in all your ways acknowledge him, and he will direct your paths. And I'm going, that's just what I have to do. And, you know, we always like to quote that, you know, he'll direct our paths, he will lead us. But the first part of that is trust in the Lord with mm-hmm. all your heart. And that's very important. It's hard to do sometimes. Mm-hmm. And again, I don't like to look at the circumstances too much. I'm a realist, though. If something needs to be fixed, you got to fix it.
Yeah, yeah.
And so if there's bleeding in a company, fix it. You know, and I've had to let people go, important people in my companies go, because it was the right thing to do. But I've always led things with, I had the trust in the Lord.
Yeah, I love that. That's my favorite verse. Actually, my mom gave it to me in a frame for my 13th birthday. And it's kind of been like the verse that I think on all the time. So I love that you brought that up. That gave me chills. And it's so true, too. Okay, let's talk about where we are right now. Innovation Connector. So it was about 15 years ago that you stepped into your role? How did that start?
I walked in first day, August 2nd, 2010. So 16 plus years ago.
16 plus years. Okay. And how did that opportunity come about?
Well, I had been in a manufacturing company, owned that business, and circumstances were such that someone came and offered to buy our company, and I thought it was a good time. And I did have a business partner at the time, who was a kind of a equity silent partner.
Yeah.
But we decided to sell. There was a lot of circumstances in his life that needed that, and so we sold it. We didn't get rich. I did okay, but I didn't get rich. And I was just going to think that I'd take a couple months. This was in early November of the year, and I just thought, I think it was like 2007. I'm just going to enjoy the winter and maybe spring and summer, because I really didn't have to work at that time for that. And then I thought, if I can make it through the winter, then in spring and summer, I'm going to play golf every day, right?
Yeah.
So after about 1 week of being home in November, getting all the stuff that I needed to get done that I thought would take like 3 months, I was so bored. I thought, I'm ready to go do something. So I decided that I'd helped people with their businesses. If you've got a successful business, people come to you and say, hey, could you help me with this? And this was just the time frame where the idea of entrepreneurship and stuff started blooming. And so I thought, man, I can help people. And so I thought about starting my own consulting company to help people, but then I really didn't know what I would deliver. I knew I could help people, but that's not enough to kind of get a contract. And so I started working. I saw this opportunity with the Indiana Small Business Development Center, which does help for small businesses and such. Mm-hmm. I just saw this opportunity. They're looking for like a regional assistant director for this. And there were like 50 some people interviewed for it, and I got it. Mm-hmm. And it was very low pay.
Yeah. But
again, I did it for...
You didn't do it for the money.
I did it for experience, really.
Yep.
And after just a short period of time, I was the regional director. Then for the Innovation Connector, the person who was the executive director, was let go. It just wasn't working real well here. And I saw the position open, and I thought, I was born to do that. And so I worked with their board and such, and I got hired to do this. And what a great opportunity.
Yeah.
What a great opportunity. I've had so much fun. Mm-hmm. Someone said, well, you're past 65 or whatever. Why aren't you retired? What else would I do? But I love what I do.
Mm-hmm.
And so, some people say, well, if you love what you do and, it brings joy to you and there's people supporting you do that and you love getting up in the morning and go and do what you do, then don't stop doing it.
Yeah.
And I said, all that's good except let's rephrase something. when I get up in the morning. Once I get up in the morning, I like going, and I don't like to get up in the morning anymore. But anyway, so.
That's great. So for people who may not know, what is the Innovation Connector and what does it exist to do?
In simple phrase, we are a business incubator, much like a NICU unit for a baby. They used to put them in, but they call it incubators. But someone who may be early in their stage, but maybe not fully developed. And so what we do is we help businesses in that same way. So starting businesses, and then also we help businesses grow. Mm-hmm. So we always say we can help, we have resources to help people from the moment of like the thought or the idea, from idea generation all the way to exit. And so we've helped people all the way. This facility at 1208 West White River Boulevard, where our headquarters and our offices are, is just really a hub for this type of activity. We do have plenty of offices all around our facility where we lease offices to businesses. We don't just provide offices, we provide offices with support. And so people here get the meaningful support and resources they need to help them, coaching, advising, marketing, accounting, and such. But then we also help about 450 different businesses outside of our four walls.
Oh, nice.
So in our community, in our region. So we call ourselves an entrepreneurial support organization, or ESO. And we're the only full-service largest ESO in East Central Indiana.
Oh, nice.
We've grown so much, and we've helped thousands of people, which is, again, brings joy to me.
Yeah. You've touched on this already, kind of, but what would you say drew you personally to that mission? Why do you love it so much?
Well, this is who I am. And so I just saw this as a great platform. And again, I say platform, stage, pulpit, whatever you want, from where I can exercise my God-given gifts. We all have something, but this is just where I do it. And so the idea of helping others, the mission was so pure. We don't charge for our services. We receive funding otherwise. And I just thought I could use my business experience and my knowledge because I knew I could help others. And so since 2010, we've just found a lot of new ways to help people. So. Mm-hmm.
You've been described as someone who genuinely wants to see other people succeed, and even in this interview, I've seen that firsthand. Where does that mindset come from, do you think?
Well, first of all, that was that's a gift from God. I don't know how else to say it, because it's not something I woke up in the morning going, hey, you know, I'm going to see everybody succeed. But I also think it was ingrained in me, and also something that I was taught and caught was from my father. That was who he was. He wanted to see other people succeed. Mr. Amos, the mentor of my business life, who I bought the first business from, he told me one time, and I'll never forget this, he said, just remember, for you to be successful, you have to make everyone around you successful, and you have to allow them to be successful. And I'll never forget that, because I've helped so many people in the companies and the things that I do become and be more successful. Even to the sometimes at my own expense, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't bother me. And so for me, that was a really, really big thing. So, yeah. But most of all, I believe it is a gift from God. And I think we're kind of the sum total of all of our experiences and our life and our education and such. It's just where I'm at right now. That's all.
Yeah. What was it like shifting from building your own businesses to helping others build theirs?
There was no real issue at all, because it was an extension of one to the other.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is that I could help people and not have my own money in it. That kind of relieved that a little bit.
No pressure, like lessens the pressure a bit,
And I never actively looked like, oh, I want to sell this business, I want to get out of it. But there were times where things happened in a certain order where you're going to go, wow, that's just probably time to do this. And so, I just think it was a natural progression. It was time for me to step out of business ownership. So I don't own any business right now. Sometimes I think I need to get back into it somehow. But to do what I do here at the Innovation Connector, it's really the same thing. I have built a business and organization here from tiny to pretty much big.
Mm-hmm. So, 100%. Can you share a few stories of entrepreneurs or businesses you've seen grown? That really meant something to you?
Well, what means more to me than anything is seeing the entrepreneurs grow.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an attorney here in town. Her name's Leslie Mathewson. Leslie later in life got her law degree, and she worked for a law firm here in town. And Leslie came to me one day and said, can I come and talk to you? And I only know her because I utilize her services on a legal matter business-wise. And so she came over, and we had gone to church together. And she came over and she goes, hey, look, I'm going to venture out on my own, create my own legal office. But I'm an attorney, but I don't know how to do that. I know how to do the X's and O's, you know, to get it done. She said, I don't know how to run a business. I don't know how to get. So she came to the Innovation Connector, which was a little odd. It was a different kind of business for us. We try to focus more on technology and such. But she was a great example of someone I could help. And so she started in a small office, went to a bigger office, hired some people, and now she has her own law office here and in Winchester. Just seeing that was a really cool thing. We have a gentleman who is now our executive director. His name is Frank Scott II. And Frank, oh my gosh, years and years ago, he came to me asking me for some business help. And he was working in the world and, you know, in a business. And then he wanted to start his own business. And so I can just remember helping him bits and pieces. Mm-hmm. I remember him because we used to live in the same neighborhood, and he played with my son when they were like 5 and 6 years old. So there was kind of a little attachment.
Yeah.
So I helped Frank all the way through his business upbringing. And he owned his business. He was supplying for his family. He even actually quit his full-time job to do full-time in his business, which is always a success. He received one of our prestigious awards that we pass out every year. It was the Champion Entrepreneur of the Year. And then seeing him now become basically part of our succession planning, that he's being set up to take my place when I retire sometime. And so just seeing that all of his experiences are allowing him to be a really good executive director. So it's more than just that business. I like to see the person. And then a person both you and I know, Carter Anderson, is a great example. You know, Carter, we worked with him at Ball State. His business plan ideas and known the family so well. But, you know, Carter has come to see me many, many, many times about some business ventures and things like that. Actually worked with us a short period of time here. Mm-hmm. But those type of people, just I love working with. So, you know, there's some really success stories there. We could go in, you know, I was just thinking of tons of them. But where I really like it are the, you know, you can go to some of the bigger businesses I helped and some of the more well-done startups and such. But I like it when we're finding someone who never could believe in themselves. And they might have, I mean, a little thing of maybe having a catering business.
Mm-hmm.
And although you can get overrun with people who want your help doing that, you know, I can pick who I want, kind of. But the interesting part of that is, you know, I've been able to help some people that probably no one else would have helped.
Yeah.
And I call them there, you know, a lot of times this is from the underserved population, but they're the outliers. They're the unnoticed. And to see them go from nobody notices me to having a good business going on, there's just something about that. Because to me, that's real life.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing the person grow as a person, see the confidence that they build up in themselves, see the little swagger that they get,
uh-huh.
and see the confidence that they never had before. The business stuff is all going to take care of itself.
Mm-hmm.
You build the people, it's going to be fine.
Oh, I like that. That's good. You've impacted countless people, but rarely take credit. Why is it important for you to stay humble in that way?
Well, there's really no need. There's no credit to take. The people that come to me or the people that I work with, they do all the hard work.
Mm-hmm.
I just give experience and a little bit of knowledge that I can do and maybe, you know, direct them in the right way. But, you know, I'm just trying to be faithful to the platform that God's given me.
Mm-hmm.
There's really no credit to take. And I don't want to go, well, I helped that person or whatever. I've been on the other side. I know what it takes to start a business. I know what it's to get it launched. They're doing the hard work. They're investing the money and all that stuff. So, you know, I don't know if it's as much being humble as just realizing it that I really didn't have anything to do with it.
Yeah, fair. Some leaders do try to take credit, though, so that's why I think it's just a mindset.
Yeah, to me, it's like next. I just want to help somebody. And I think the real value is that we don't need to take credit for anything. I think the real credit is, you know, seeing their success. Mm-hmm. I help students in the Ball State Entrepreneurship Program, and you know, 8-10 years later, after I've helped them in their program, you know, they'll come back and they'll say, "Hey, are you still doing basic care? You know, can I stop by and see you sometime? You remembered me, you know." I get business owners who sees me on the street, and we'll go to the store, like Meyer, my wife and I, and someone will stop and say, "Hi there," and she goes, "My wife said, like, who's that?" "Oh, I helped them like 10 years ago with their business." "Well, they have a good business now," and I go, "Yeah, I know. That's good. They worked hard at it." So those type of things, when you get like, that's a joy to me.
Yes, for sure. How has your faith shaped the way you lead and encourage others?
It's the core of who I am. It's everything that I have inside of me. So I don't compartmentalize my faith, my work, you know, anything like that. My relationship with Jesus is intertwined with 100% of everything that I do. So I know I can't separate them in any way. So, you know, I often will say, because I've worked with some people in business and such here at the Innovation Connect Room before, who were people who were not easy to love. Sometimes people were hard to get to and through, right? Mm-hmm. I always think about like, yeah, I wonder if Jesus were here, what would he do?
You know,
and not that the old phrase, "What would Jesus do?" But like, really, how would he handle this? Mm-hmm. I sincerely have in the core of who I am is that everyone has been created in the image of God.
Yeah.
And so my job is to find that image, because sometimes when we look on the humanness side of things, it's not fun. But it's my job to find where they are created in the image of God and how I can help that. So, in my mind, I cannot separate what I do from my faith. I don't know if I should do this or not. We're nonprofit. People come in all the time, and you know, usually they open up about a struggle or whatever. I'm like, "I'm not a counselor. I just want to help you with your business."
Yeah.
But they start getting trust in you anyway, and their business. And I would say at least half of the entrepreneurs that I talk to and business owners that I talk to, before they leave, I always ask if I can pray with them. 100% everybody says yes. No one's going to say no. But, you know, I said, "Well, you know, we'll be okay if I just, you know, pray with you for this. I think there's something special going on," or whatever. And most of the time I open my eyes and there's tears running down theirs.
Yeah.
So that's what a platform's for, right?
Yeah.
So.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing. What do you think makes a great entrepreneur beyond just having a good idea?
A passion. Mm-hmm. You know, people are passionate about a lot of things, but if you can direct your passion toward, you know, that idea, that business idea, whatever, having determination, stick-to-itiveness, we call it stickiness, mm-hmm. But also having a practical plan with action. Passion does not start a business on its own. We get this idea, and, you know, we all have friends who talk about their new business idea, and they're just, blah, 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 blah. They just have so much energy for it, and it's going to be so great, but passion doesn't keep your business going. It really helps light the fuse to get it started.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to have practical steps in order to make it work. I always call it the passion and the practical. So one without the other isn't going to work. Passion will light the fuse, but practical will keep it going.
Yeah.
It's really, really important to see that, because I've seen a lot of passion driven people burn out quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So
makes sense.
It's kind of like a marriage, and that is, you know, passion may drive you to the wedding altar, right? But it's not going to keep you married.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
Okay, we've talked a lot about faith and how it's like everything that you do, it's ingrained. But you clearly lived a life focused on serving others. How has your faith guided that mindset, or is it just... what it is.
It's just become nature, second nature to me. I wake up every morning. I like the, my prayer time is in the morning and in the evening. And, you know, I'm one of these people, you know, there's, you know, I always, you know, wake up saying, good morning, Lord. You know, some people wake up saying, good Lord, it's morning, right? But, but I say, good morning, Lord. And I just say, Lord, I give you this day and everything with it and everything in it. You know, they always say it's all in a day. Well, I give that to the Lord all in the day at the beginning. So I that's just my mindset from the beginning. And so it does. It's just I won't say it's second nature because anything we do has to be intentional. Mm-hmm. But and it's so exciting just to think that we have the God of the universe walking with us into our offices.
Yeah.
And you don't know everybody who's coming in that door today. You don't know what kind of life they've had or live or day they've had. Might have been the best day or the worst day of their life. Who knows? But today we can make a difference in someone's life, no matter what it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Have there been moments where you clearly felt God directing your steps?
Oh, yeah. So many. Probably, you know, very intentional about, like, when I started this work of the Innovation Connector, when it came about, I knew that this was going to happen. It wasn't like I want it so bad, I want to make it happen. No, I knew. Starting the businesses that I start, I've been very intentional about that. Without God, it was not possible. I've always felt His very clear guidance on that. In some hard times, you know, I've been through some times of anxiety and some depression. I think that comes with working yourself too much, you know, sometimes. But, you know, I can remember several times where in the depths of my despair, which, you know, some nights got really dark for me, is that I've heard God speak, and almost more than a still small voice. I've really heard Him speak to get me through that stuff. And so, you know, like, I'm right here with you. And, you know, there's some specific times where even had some supernatural things happen. And so, yeah, I've done that. As a father and as a husband, I don't know how you raise four kids without that. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. What scripture or life principle has guided you most?
Well, thank you for asking. I do have several. Proverbs 16:3 mm-hmm. says, commit to the Lord whatever you do, and He will establish your plans, right? I have several other scriptures I love. But in your hearts, it's 1 Peter 3:15. But in your hearts, revere Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason of the hope that is in you. But do this with gentleness and respect.
That's so Peter, what?
1 Peter 3:15. And then Psalm 32, verse 8, my life scripture, that says, I will instruct you and teach you in the way which you should go. I will counsel you with my loving eye upon you. That's been my life scripture right there. Mm-hmm. I don't know how I could make it any other way. I actually have a list of scriptures that I put it right on my desk right here.
Yep. Yeah.
And and then just another phrase that I think God breathed this to me, and I've heard other people say it, but listen. Learn to listen. Listen to understand. Don't listen to change. Don't listen to answer a question. Listen to understand.
That's great. So good. All right. So let's talk about your family. You talked about how you met your wife as she was your girlfriend in high school, and like, so how did you meet her initially in high school?
Well, remember I said I wanted to be a lifeguard.
Yes.
And I lived right across the street from the pool, and the family that lived right next to me, he was the superintendent of the Parks and Recreation Department in Adams County, Indiana. Mm-hmm. He was the one in charge of the pool.
Okay.
And so Larry, his name was Larry Rose, and Larry had promised me a job when I turned 16 because he knew my passion and such. But I had to be 16, so I turned 16 in October, so I had to wait until the next swimming year. And during that winter, Larry took another job and moved away.
Oh.
my dreams were dashed. You know, I thought, oh no. But so I met the new incoming director, and they came in from out of town, and she had a daughter. And so her daughter and I became really good friends, and that's mm-hmm. who I married now.
Yeah.
And so I did get hired. You know? And I didn't know Gail very well, but you know, we knew each other. And then that fall, something really strange happened. She went out for the men's high school swim team. Wow. We didn't have women's teams.
Oh, wow.
And her dad kept saying, well, if you want to get to know people, you got to go do something. Gail loved to swim. Uh-huh. So I always tell people we met in lane 5 at Belmont High School pool because we both swam distance. So we were both in lane 5. So we met her in lane 5. So we just became the dearest of friends. And then it was, grew into more, and just our relationship was solidified in first as a friendship.
Uh-huh.
So I think that's really the biggest part of it. So,
yeah. How did you know she was the one? I didn't put that on there, but
I didn't.
Yeah.
Because I was dumb. I was young and dumb. I didn't know that was even possible, right? I didn't even think about that stuff. But we kind of came into a thing where, you know, we went solid together for like 5-6 years. And I never thought about getting married, you know, like that. Because, like, I mean, and, you know, we were more than just friends. I mean, we held hands and stuff like that. But anyway.
Yeah.
But it just kind of was a natural progression, like, you know what? We've done this. We could be together forever. You know, we could marry, and so we just kind of. So it was, you know, in my dumb mind, I'm thinking, man, if I don't marry this girl, I've just invested 6 years of my life into her, my time, my money, and if I don't marry her, I'm gonna have to start over with someone else. I'm going. I'm not doing that. That's a little facetious, but the idea was, you know, that. You know, we just, our friendship led to this.
Uh-huh.
And we had such a strong base.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm glad of that.
Yeah. And when did you get married?
We got married in May 26th, 1979.
So coming up on how many years then?
In May, which was just a month away, we'll be married 47 years.
Wow, that's a long time. So
that is a really long time to the same person, yes.
what has marriage taught you about love and commitment?
Marriage is hard, just like starting a business. Marriage is hard, more so because when I own my businesses, I was a leader and I could change things if I wanted it. And marriage is like, I'm the one that has to change.
Yeah, yeah.
I understand, too, how... I understand it's long term, and if you go into a marriage thinking that this is a short term satisfaction thing where I've got to immediately be satisfied with everything, it's not going to work. You got to think of long term. And in my mind, so I grew up in a generation, you know, I didn't know the word divorce ever, but in my mind, I grew up that there were no excuses not to make it work.
Yeah.
You had to make it work. That was just what you did. And I understand divorce, and I understand the struggles, and it really is hard and it hurts people. But in our mind, it was never an idea of that.
No.
I remember, I think it was Dr. Billy Graham and his wife, they were celebrating their 60th wedding anniversary, I believe. Her name's Ruth. And someone asked, a reporter or something asked Dr. Graham, you know, that said, you know, being married for 60 years is a long time. Just, you know, in this celebration time, was there ever a time that you thought divorce? And he goes, you know, in his deep southern drawl, I said, nah, not divorce. Murder, yes, but not divorce. And I'm thinking, yeah, that's right, you know. So, but the idea is like, yeah. So
you're in it.
For me, I just know that I always have someone in my corner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. What do you say the key to a successful marriage is?
Just not being so bullheaded that you have to be right.
Yeah.
I won't say giving in, but just understanding from the perspective, you know, listen to understand. Mm-hmm. My wife is very wise. She's very, very practical and very intuitive. And so I've learned to listen to that, you know. But I've learned to listen to her, you know. And so I think the key is people always say, well, communication and stuff like that. Whatever. No, please. You know, it is important. But the other thing is just hanging with each other.
Yeah.
You know, someone said, I love my spouse, but I don't like her. I've heard people say that before. So find out a way to like her.
You want to be friends? Friendship.
That's right.
And you said you have four kids?
Just four.
Yeah. Four, yep. What is your favorite part about being a dad?
Oh, just seeing each of them grow up as their unique self.
Mm-hmm.
All four of my kids are so different from each other.
Yeah.
And they all have their own, you know, their own way of living. And, you know, now they, you know, most of them have families. All but one basically is married. It's just watching them grow up and be on their own, mm-hmm. Off of my payroll, you know. So,
yeah.
No. Yeah, yes, the dad in me. But,
yeah.
You know, just seeing them do things on their own and do, you know, like,
yeah.
I'm so darn proud of them, you know. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah. What are their names?
My oldest is Rachel. Uh-huh. Rachel is the assistant principal at Royerton Elementary.
Uh-huh.
Or as people out there call it, Rorton.
Rorton, yeah.
And then my daughter, Sarah, she lives in the Zionsville area. And she works in customer support. She's got a really good job in software industry. My son, Jay, lives in the Indianapolis area, and he works in the food industry. He works mm-hmm. in assisted living and stuff like that.
He's oh, nice.
Kind of a chef type yeah. of leader.
Cool.
As of today, it's just a week or two away from having their first baby, so that's really exciting.
Yeah.
And then our daughter, our youngest, is Grace.
Uh-huh.
And Grace lives in South Bend.
Uh-huh.
And so, after four, like, oh my gosh, how do we have four kids, right? And I saw a scripture. I showed my wife in church one day. She said I was taking it out of context. But it says, it says, grace is sufficient for thee. So I figured we were done. So anyway.
That's hilarious. You're also a grandfather.
Oh,
how many grandkids do you have?
We have six plus one coming any day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's the best part about this stage of life?
Oh, just being, we can do fun things with them, right?
Uh-huh.
We're not in charge of sometimes their well-being.
Uh-huh.
So we like to do fun things with
them. Oh, yeah.
And even like this weekend, we have our 8-year-old grandson, Theo, with us this weekend. And his mom is visiting another daughter somewhere. And it's you know, we just get them for the weekend. It's just
yeah,
so good.
It's
but,
so fun.
It's, you know, people always say, well, you can spoil them and then send them home. But we like to spoil them and then keep them at our house. We like them to stay overnight and stuff
yeah.
like that.
Yeah.
I woke up this morning to Theo looking me in the eyes and say, Grandpa, it's time to wake up. and then he said, are you going to take me to Concannon's and get a donut? I'm up. So just stuff like that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. What values were most important for you to pass down to your kids and then hopefully like down to your grandkids?
Love for Jesus. I've never been ashamed to tell them about my love for Jesus. And that's the base of everything that I do. Jesus, you know, serving him, serving others, that love never fails. I think the biggest thing I can do is be an example as a father and a husband to my kids and my grandkids. Because, again, they'll catch it,
yeah.
you know. But then just to make sure that they know that, first of all, God is faithful, and I'm faithful too.
Yeah.
And I'm always in my kids' corner. I mean, we've been through some really tough hardships, drug addictions, and things like that in our house. But you know, we've always been in their corner. I want them to know their mom and dad's faithfulness to them and to each other, but also God's faithfulness in living proof, in living color, in living action has happened. So
yeah.
I don't take that lightly. I don't take that. At all. I mean, it's just been because he has proven himself over and over and over and over again. There's no denying it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. How did you balance work, leadership, and being present for your family?
Oh, my gosh. That's so hard because creating companies, you're working 12, 14 hours a day, every day. It's just part of it. So first of all, I've always seen my role of a father as being the provider. I take that seriously. Just like a settler or a pioneer going across the plains of the West, you know, settling a household. But, you know, they would go out in the morning and come back at sundown and, you know, they worked 7 days a week, you know, and if they didn't go out to the fields and plant or take care of the crops and take care of the livestock, they may not eat in the spring or fall, right?
Yeah.
And so I always seen that my faithfulness to provide is important, and I know faithfulness to provide is more than just money. Mm-hmm. So I don't very much go with the thought of a work-life balance. That's a big phrase right now. I don't agree with it.
Yeah.
There's never going to be a work-life balance. You cannot. But there are work-life choices.
I like that.
Yeah. So there are work-life choices. And so so you think of work-life balance as kind of a long-term thing. But work-life choices are choices that you make every day. And so to me, that's really important. Am I going to choose to not have schedule meetings at 3 o'clock on a Friday or Thursday to go until 5 because at 5:30 my granddaughter's playing tennis at Delta, right? Uh-huh. Or whatever. So, you know, those are choices I make. Okay, look, my meetings stop at 4 because I'm going to my granddaughter's tennis match. Mm-hmm. Those are choices you make.
Yeah.
So, and so choices will lead up to maybe a lifestyle, but we have work-life choices that we need to make.
Mm-hmm. Side note, I'll probably see you at a bunch of those matches. My sister Katie is a senior at Delta tennis team.
Lucy is a freshman, so.
Yeah, I think I told because I was at my parents' house earlier, and I told them who I was going to interview, and she was like, oh, I know Lucy. Like, Katie was saying that she's doing really well and stuff.
Yeah, she loves it. She loves it.
Well, Tim is great, too. Like, talk about a leader that you want your...
I know. Lucy said, Grandpa, you know, for the first couple of days, yeah, we talked about, you know, it's tennis, we play tennis, but then, so cool, he kind of teaches stuff about life.
Yeah, he does. No, he really, yeah. Yeah, I was actually reading one of the sheets that they sent the team back with when I was home a couple weeks ago, because he was my coach, obviously, because I played tennis too, and he hasn't changed.
I know.
Yeah, he's great. What are you most proud of when you look at your family today?
Two things. First of all, my family shows up for each other, for others. If we're saying, hey, we're going to have a gathering, our family shows up. If someone's in need, our family shows up. And that is so cool.
Yeah.
Because not a lot of families do that. So we show up. And the second thing is, I love it that my oldest two daughters, who I could say weren't always the closest, that they were good sisters. Mm-hmm. They're the besties right now.
Yeah,
and they live in different towns and such like that, but they're all the time together. And you know, they get together with their kids without grandma and I. Uh-huh. It's almost appalling, you know.
Yeah, it's like, you why weren't we invited?
That's right. But you know, and the part of it was good job. So those are two things I'm really proud of.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about some character and legacy type things. People describe you as incredibly selfless and generous, which I would say the same now. What does generosity mean to you?
I think generosity is more, it's not about what you have to give, but it's more about what you're willing to give to others. Mm-hmm. So it's like you don't give because you have, you give just because you have to give. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, generosity is a heart thing. I think it comes from God himself. Especially in this Easter time that we're talking, that God freely gave up his son. And it was, he freely gave him for us. And then Jesus gave his life for us. And so basically that's you know, Jesus lived selflessly too. I mean, he was always doing something for other people. But, you know, I think so many people think, well, if I had more, I'd give. I have a former pastor, Greg Parris, who used to say, if God can get it through you, he's going to get it to you. And I love that because sometimes it's things, if God can get it to you, you know, you can get it through you. No, he said, if God can get it through you first, then he'll give it to you. First of all, work with what you have. And so that's, to me, that's the best thing is, It doesn't matter what I have. It doesn't matter what a person has. It's what do you do with what you have? Mm-hmm. I heard some statistics one time, and that was they're talking about the most generous states. They ranked all 50 states in the matter of generosity, the rate of giving to them.
Yeah.
And the number one state of giving per person was Mississippi. They wow. also ranked the top 50 states of the most wealthy states, and Mississippi ranked last. So you take from that is that people who don't have give more than anything. It's the woman with, you know, with nothing that, you know, gave her last. Gave her last.
Yeah. That's crazy.
And on top of that, the state that gave the least was the state that had the most.
What state was
it? Connecticut. And so to me, it's just really an interesting thing because it doesn't matter what you have. And you know what? I'm also a big believer in, it's not always about money and things. It's about, can you pass a kind word in season? If someone needs a good word, if they need an attaboy or an attagirl.
Yeah.
I've been known to be an encourager. Been known to be an encourager.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's, yeah, goes a long way.
Yeah. What motivates you to keep investing in other people's success?
What else is there?
Yeah.
I mean, I've always said, you know, I've been really blessed, and you know, if I quit work today, we're fine, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I've just always thought, and I say this very carefully, but it's not that hard to earn a living just to live, okay? It's not that hard. You can go get a job, and you may not live high on the you know, the mountain,
yeah,
or whatever, but there's always a way to survive, especially mm-hmm. with the generosity of our communities and such.
Mm-hmm.
But investing in other people, you're never going to go wrong. And so, like, what's the risk? You know, like, if I invest in this person and I don't get something, I'm still going to make a living. You know, I'm still mm-hmm. going to be fine. So I just think it's really important that, and it goes to being, who are you serving, yourself or others?
Yeah.
That's all what that's about, so.
Mm-hmm. When someone comes to you discouraged or unsure of themselves, what do you usually try to remind them of?
Seasons change in life. You know, winter isn't always there. There comes a spring and a summer.
Mm-hmm.
A really good friend of mine, his name's Ray Bolts, wrote a song called Seasons Change. And that has stuck with me for many, many years. And, you know, I always tell people, just if you can hang on one more minute, one more step, that's all that's required. We're not required to run the marathon. We're required to take the next step. Just make sure it's not off a cliff. But and then, you know, it's one more decision. And if people are in despair, I always look at them and say, what's the downside of asking God for help? Obviously, what we're doing isn't working.
Yeah.
Maybe we should reach out and say, this is beyond me. So I just try to, you know, give people a good word. Mm-hmm. I try to find something positive in their life that we can celebrate. Yeah. I'm a celebrator. I love to celebrate things in other people's uh-huh. lives. So
that's great. Looking back, what are you most grateful for?
Oh, almost 50 years ago in October. 50 years ago in October. Sitting up in Pruess Hall, Ball State University. Second to the top row, second seat in from the right side. That's right where I made my decision to follow Christ for the first time.
Oh, really?
And I look back and I'm thinking, preordained before the foundations of the world. I somewhere along the line, it was, you know, this was going to happen, but you know, I accepted. And since then, I have not looked back one single time. God opened my eyes that I needed a Savior, Jesus, and I will never, ever, you know, I don't regret that a minute. Never have looked back. Never reconsidered anything. Never. I mean, it was just all or nothing at that point. But then since then, you know, my family has been, you know, what I'm so grateful for. I mean, you can go through the motions of having kids, creating kids, but it's really, that's just part one. Part two is when they live, you know, and with you, and you teach them and have grandkids. I mean, how does that all happen, you know?
Yeah.
And so I'm so grateful for that. And but again, I live as a very thankful man.
Yeah. As you look back on your life so far, who has had the biggest impact on you and why?
By far my wife, Gail. Mm-hmm. You know, spending that much time with each other, 56 years, really close. She has taught me to love in real time. You know, it's not this, you know, down the road or the past, but in real time living. We've taught each other how to forgive. And she's also taught me how to pour myself into other people. So mm-hmm. she's that example in my home, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if I can do it at home, I can do it really anywhere.
Yeah.
So she has been by far the biggest impact on my life, mm-hmm. without a doubt, as a physical person.
Yeah. You said this kind of earlier, that you don't have any regrets. You stand by that with this question, too? Do you have any, or things you would do differently?
I knew you were going to ask this question, and this was the one question that I spent most time thinking about.
Really?
And I can't think of one thing. Would I want to change the outcome of some things? Yeah, some of the hurtful things and hard things.
Yeah.
But I don't have regrets on any of it because they've all had a place in my life. And I've always known that this is just part of that journey that I've had to take. And so I don't really have any regrets. And one thing that our family, where I said we show up, but one of the things that I think our family, this is kind of our motto, is that we don't live with regrets.
Yeah.
So that's why we show up. We don't ever have to worry about like, oh, I wish I'd have done this or whatever. We do if we can. If we can't, there's no regrets. And yeah. So, yeah, I don't have any regrets.
It's good. It's a good thing to be able to live with.
Yeah. I know. I just thought, man, I feel weird even saying that, but I really don't.
Well, even like the things that you said, like some of the hurtful things like go differently, but I feel like all the seemingly bad things that have happened, at least in my life so far too, like have ended up being good, or like I learned a lot from that had I not gone through that.
We don't develop character by what we are successful at and what we're good at. It's all the hard things. When you played tennis, did you hit every shot in bounds?
No.
So anyway.
Uh-huh. For sure. What advice would you give to the younger generations?
Make a difference where you can and when you can. It's, you know, my parents used to say, oh, you guys have, you know, this is, I grew up in the, you know, I was born in 57, so grew up in the 60s and early 70s, and oh, you guys have it so good, so lucky, you know. We had it rough, you know. They walked to school 3 miles uphill, and they had to come home 3 miles uphill, which I never understood that. But anyway, you have it so easy, and but to the generation now, yes, life has changed, but you don't have it any harder than any other generation.
Yeah.
You really, really don't. And you have the opportunity to make a difference in your generation, just like I do. And so go do it. Go do it. Quit talking about stuff. Some of this generation, last couple of sectors of generation, I have found out there's a lot of talk. A lot of people like to talk about things, but go do it. Go make a difference. And I have been a big believer in making a difference in my corner of the world. I can't impact what's happening in China or the Soviet Union right now. I really cannot. I mean, yes, does it impact me somehow? Probably somewhere along the
road. Yeah,
but what I can change is my circle. I can change me first and then my circle. And I think that's really, really important to realize that I'm not expected to go to Washington, D.C. and change Congress's viewpoint on something. That doesn't have much to do with me. And I love the political realm and I love all that stuff. But when it comes to real life decisions, it's on the home front. It's my front first.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it all begins with us. It begins with me.
Mm-hmm. Your attitude, your choice.
People want to complain about stuff, but I would say, hey, just look at yourself first. So.
Uh-huh. Yeah. That's so good. I wrote it down, obviously. It's good. How do you hope your children and grandchildren remember you someday?
I was a thankful person. Mm-hmm. There was nobody else that they ever knew that had more gratefulness about life and living life than I did, you know, because that's the way I want to be remembered. And also that there is a tremendous amount of love for them and others, no matter what. You know, the door is always open.
Yeah. At the end of the day, what do you believe is the most important thing in life?
Knowing and accepting the saving power of Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. It's not a dream. It's not a joke. It's not a, you know, a made up thing. There's just, we come to a point where we know that we know that we know that we know that we know. There's just nothing that can convince us otherwise. Mm-hmm. It's not an emotion. It's not just like, oh, it's the right thing. You know, the thing that we should do. You know, whatever. I know that I know that I know, and whom I believed. And it's almost like when you find that soulmate. That for when I found my wife, and you know, you kind of knew, like you said, how do you know it's the one? She was the one. Mm-hmm. Is that you just know? Mm-hmm. And there's something that nobody could convince me otherwise. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I've said it this way. If somebody came up to me and said, "Hey, can I tell you something privately?" And I go, "Okay, what?" And they go, "I think your wife's having an affair," you know. And I go, "No, she isn't."
Yeah.
I can guarantee you. They go, "Well, how do you?" And I go, "Because I know that I know that I know, and she knows that she knows she knows. I mean, we know."
Yeah.
And I'm sure people said that, but I mean, I'm just saying honestly, we know.
Yeah.
We are that committed. We understand each other. We run each other's heartbeats, you know, stuff like mm-hmm. that.
You are one.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's the same way with Jesus in our lives, is that we know that we know. We know. And I'm just speechless when I think about that, because I just wish everybody could feel and understand and comprehend that. And it's really hard until you do. It's really hard to tell people what real love is until you experience it.
Yeah.
But we do live in a mixed up, hard, screwed up world. We always have. Mm-hmm. So it's nothing new.
Even like, yeah, you read the Old Testament, it's like, it's always been messed up.
It's been
like,
worse.
It's been, yeah, way worse then. Like, people are like, oh, like, yeah. So bad. It's like, it's, every period's been bad.
But there's always been that hope of Christ, mm-hmm. so.
Yep. And then, last question. I've really enjoyed this conversation. How do you hope to be remembered in, like, a broader sense, just in the world around you?
They will remember me that I was a follower of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't want to be remembered as a Christian.
Yeah.
Because that's so many connotations. And yes. I've traveled the world, and sometimes Christian's a good thing, sometimes it's a bad thing. But when you tell people that you're a follower of Jesus, there's no doubt.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want to be known, I hope people know me as a follower of Jesus who loved his family, was faithful to his family, faithful to his work, and faithful to his life. That's all. Mm-hmm. The world owes me nothing, you know. Someone said when I leave the Innovation Connector, oh, they want to have this big party and they want to have this celebration. I don't want anything, because it's just never been about me. And so I don't want it to be that. I don't want my life to be what was about me. I want the biggest reward I can get is see people out there being successful. But then the biggest success is when they're helping other people become successful, because they really got what I was sharing.
Chain reaction.
Yeah.
Well, that's really powerful.
I've enjoyed this conversation. It's really helped me dig down a little bit and think a little bit, because it's so, sometimes we get so busy in living our lives, we forget about, you know, those things. It's like people, I tell people in business, you're working so hard in your business, you forget to work on your business. And so this was kind of like working on, you know, the questions of my faith and such. So thank you.
I'm so glad that you enjoyed it. Thank you so much for taking the time. I mean, you have Theo with you, and I've taken up some of your time.
All right, he's with Grandma right now and his aunt, so that's great.
Okay, well, that's good.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Words of the Wise. One thing I kept coming back to throughout my conversation with Ted was his commitment to helping other people succeed. In a world that often encourages us to focus on ourselves, Ted's life is a reminder that some of the greatest joys come from investing in others, celebrating their victories, and using whatever gifts we've been given to serve the people around us. I also loved something Ted said near the end of our conversation. Make a difference where you can and when you can. It's simple advice, but powerful. We may not be able to change the whole world, but we can impact the people right in front of us. If you enjoyed this episode, I would love for you to share it with a friend, family member, coworker, mentor, or someone who could use a little encouragement today. As always, thank you for being here, thank you for listening, and thank you for helping us preserve the stories and wisdom that deserve to be remembered. Until next time, keep asking questions, keep listening, and keep learning from those who have walked the road before us. We'll catch you next time.